You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Sebastian Cohn. I'm a program officer with the public health program here. So welcome to this lunch talk, which, to draw your attention to it, we called Sex, Drugs, and Canadian Politics. Though in hindsight, we should have probably called it something more alluring, like Sex, Drugs, and Strategic Litigation, which is what it's going to be about.
Canadian politics.
We're extremely fortunate to be joined by Katrina Pacey and Adrian Smith from one of the public health program's key grantees, the Pivot Legal Society. Pivot is based in Vancouver, Canada, and uses the law to address some of the root causes of poverty and social exclusion. Pivot engages in legal advocacy and strategic litigation to address issues related to, for example, policing, drug policy, housing, sex work, and violence against women. So over the next hour and a bit, you'll hear from Pivot's Executive Director, Katrina Pacey, who will discuss Pivot's political and legal strategies in the aftermath of the now-famous Bedford case. After Katrina, I think that's the order we're doing, Katrina and then Adrian. Mm-hmm. After Katrina, we'll hear Adrian talk about Pivot's health and drug policy campaign, and there'll be plenty of time for Q&A after the presentations. But with that, I'll hand it over to you, Katrina.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming into OSF, for your incredible support, and for having us here today. I'm slowly waking up. Got in the middle of the night, so I'll be a little bit slow out of the gate, and then I'm sure I'll pick up speed as we go. My name's Katrina, and I'm the executive director of Pivot. That's a pretty new role for me. I was the lead campaigner and lawyer on Pivot's sex work law reform project, and now have moved into this new role. But I'm going to focus today and talk to you about Pivot's work on sex workers' rights in Canada. And the inspiration for my talk today is this image, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the moment when I took this photo and what it represented for me. This was a really landmark day. This was a really historic day. But it was not the day that the Bedford hearing happened. It was not the day the Bedford decision came down. This is December 6th of 2014. This is the day that Canada enacted its new, extremely harmful prostitution laws. So this was a very devastating day for the movement. It was a very difficult day after decades of hard work and a decade of work by Pivot and sex workers to litigate this very important issue. And the government responded with laws that were as bad or possibly worse than the laws that were struck down. And I'm going to focus on this day in part because as I took this photo, I was sort of sitting on the ground. This is in the Pivot office. And I took this photo. Everything over the last 10 years came into very sharp focus. And in fact, everything that I think may happen over the next 10 years came into sharp focus for me. So this is a really powerful and important image, and I'm going to just take a moment to tell you about what's happening in this photo, and then I'm going to use it as a like marker. I'm going to talk about before and the time leading up to when this photo was taken, and I'm going to talk about the realizations I had when I took it and the thoughts that I've had ever since about where we're headed. So this was a press conference that sex workers organized on the day the new legislation came into force. We're at the Pivot office. The woman who's sitting at the table is Carrie Porth. She is the chair of Pivot's board, is a fearless, courageous, fierce leader in the movement. A former sex worker, has been involved in advocacy over the last 10 years in a really incredible and powerful way. And Carrie is discussing the new legislation, and the theme for this day is what a difference a day makes. That was the theme for this press conference. And the reason that the very, very diverse sex workers that are standing behind Carrie are masked is because the day before this moment in time when the legislation came into force, these sex workers felt recognized. They felt like they finally had rights in Canada. They had a voice. They no longer had to be silenced and hidden. They felt like they could be who they were, which was working people in the world with rights and entitlements and recognition and dignity and a voice. This day is when the new laws took effect and came into force, and these sex workers felt very, very different. the men, trans, and women sex workers there that work indoors, on street, as healers, and in many, many diverse aspects and parts of the industry, all of a sudden were returned to that hidden and isolated and very voiceless place that they had known so well. So this was an incredibly, incredibly powerful moment when these sex workers were speaking out against the new laws and talking about how, over the course of one day, they had been returned into the shadows and returned to this place where they no longer felt recognized. And so now let's flash back and let's talk a little bit about what led up to that day. And let's talk a little bit about the Bedford case, which, of course, was also an incredible, monumental moment for human rights in Canada. So this is an image of the day of the hearing, which was June 13th of 2013. This was by far and hands down one of the best days of my professional life as the movement, you know, took its place on the steps of the Supreme Court of Canada, as lawyers like myself had the unbelievable privilege to step in through those courtroom doors and address the nine justices of the Supreme Court of Canada. And it was an unbelievable moment, and it was an unbelievable hearing. The tension in the room was like you could cut it with a knife. The tension out here, you can't see it, but there's actually a line down from the middle of the staircase. They had actually cordoned off the area outside the court because they knew there would be two protests taking place. They knew that on the Red Umbrella side, there would be sex workers demanding rights, demanding justice, allies there saying, you know, if you really care about sex worker safety, if you really care about anyone's safety, you'll decriminalize prostitution. On the other side of that roped off area was those who were supporting criminalization as a way to eradicate prostitution and rescue sex workers from their own lives. Of course, the hearing itself was very focused on safety. That was the central theme. That was the most compelling argument at the time. That was ultimately what decided the case for the court. It was all about how the laws in Canada, which largely surrounded public communication, working indoors, and being a third party, living on the avails of prostitution, how those laws impeded or prevented sex workers from accessing safe and using safety measures to make their work safer. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later because what's very interesting is that I think that was a very strategic decision that was made to focus the case around safety. I think we're at a different place now, and this is part of the excitement of moving forward with this movement, is I think we can move beyond safety now and really start talking about dignity, equality, liberty, personal autonomy, and move into a different frame of legal argument. So I'm going to talk about that as well. What was amazing about the hearing and the lead up was the incredible movement that surrounded the litigation. And this is something that I think is no surprise to all of you, is the incredible way in which litigation becomes a focal point for social movements. How it's absolutely essential and important in the face of controversy on issues where even progressive governments have a difficult time doing the right thing because politically it's a tricky topic or they don't think it's going to generate votes. So even our more progressive governments often fail to take the right steps and do the right thing on these contentious issues. But in a country like Canada right now with an ultra-conservative government that is all about law and order, all about oppression and repression of marginalized groups, this was obviously an important piece of the strategy, and the movement was peaking in terms of its power and its voice and its strength around that time. And so ultimately, we had this beautiful decision, and I love this cartoon, which was in the Globe and Mail, a sex worker fist bumping. And this is really, you know, at the end of the day, the court made this incredible ruling. It said, yes, laws that stand between sex workers and safety are contrary to Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, a law that says that you cannot take meaningful steps to improve the conditions of your work. That is unconstitutional in this country, and those laws must be struck down. This was an incredibly powerful moment. It was everything we hoped for. But what I want to draw your attention to or let you know about is this really important paragraph that's the third to last paragraph in the judgment, where the court, after making all of these very important statements about how criminal law impacts the safety of sex workers in such profound ways, in the third to last paragraph then says, but this doesn't mean that prostitution cannot be criminalized. And of course, I'm paraphrasing terribly right now. But ultimately, they sent it back to Parliament. They said, you have 1 year to fix this. This does not mean that you can't enact new laws. This does not mean this isn't a matter of federal jurisdiction, which the government, of course, read to mean criminal law. But these laws must go. So that was read by and interpreted by the government as a directive, which of course it was not. It was the court doing what they are supposed to do, which is say, we don't make law here. What we do is weigh in on whether or not law is constitutional or not. But this paragraph became used as a powerful communications tool, and the government acted as though it was a powerful directive to them to then enact new laws and put new laws in the place of the ones that were struck down. So the year that followed from the date of the decision, which was December 20th of 2013, through that 1 year period where the government had ultimately a stay on the decision or on the ruling. So the laws remained in force for 1 year to follow. And the government was given that year, or told you have 1 year to fix these laws, and on the 1 year deadline, those laws will be struck from the criminal code. So it was an amazing year for us organizationally to try to figure out what we can do to organize and strategize to try to prevent new laws from coming into force. We knew that our chances were, it was going to be an incredible uphill battle. And our chances, given the government of the day, given what we were facing, were slim in terms of being able to block any new criminal laws from being put into place. But what we knew is that there was a range of options, from awful, 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 which would be the outright criminalization of prostitution entirely, through to a range of ways in which the government might enact laws that don't look or aren't exactly like the ones that were struck down, but are similar in terms of their effect. So this is Carrie presenting to the House of Commons Committee, and this is very much what the last year at Pivot has looked like. Many, many trips to Ottawa, many presentations to government, trying to educate both government and the public to understand that these laws were struck down for a reason. New criminal laws that target adult sex work will reproduce the harms and should not be put into force. And so the new legislation was proposed in the summer of 2014, and there was a very interesting process that followed around committee meetings and government response. And what was incredible to see and very important and a real testament to the movement was the way in which the opposition parties, the Green Party, the New Democrat Party, and the Liberal Party, responded and critiqued and opposed the law really forcefully. And I want to just pause to say what an incredible testament that was to sex workers in Canada, that they were able to work with government as effectively as they were to mount this really powerful response. The media response was overwhelmingly critical. And again, incredible work by the movement, educating journalists, making sure they understood the impact that this law was going to have. And so in the end, we had folks from Ottawa, from, our country's capital, where Parliament Hill is, telling us, like, you guys won this media battle. We've never seen anything like this in terms of conservative journalists coming out and supporting sex workers and supporting safety. It was better than I could have ever imagined in terms of opposition by media. It was amazing in terms of opposition by parties that have traditionally been fairly silent on these issues. And that in and of itself was very, very powerful to see. So back to this moment in time when we find ourselves on December 6th of 2014, which sadly and tragically is actually a national day of remembrance to around violence against women in Canada. It was a horrible reality that the government chose this day to enact laws that are going to reproduce the harms that we saw under the existing laws. And just to take a moment and to tell you what the new law says. So the new legislation has essentially five provisions. It bans purchasing sex in Canada, which comes probably as no surprise to many of us in this room who know that there's been a global movement afoot to say that banning the purchase of sex will somehow eliminate prostitution or somehow stop demand. We know better, we know what the evidence says about the harms that creates for sex workers in terms of their safety and their health and their freedoms. Nevertheless, the government really was able to pitch that as in line with ending victimization. The law prohibits advertising. And this is, of course, a very strategic and tactical way to target indoor sex work. The body house law is gone. Indoor sex work became legal. However, now you can advertise about it. So this was a very strategic way to circumvent that finding, but find new ways to prevent indoor sex work from taking place. There's a law, the communicating for the purpose of prostitution law was struck down. However, we now have a law that bans communication anywhere at any time by clients, indoor, outdoor, anywhere. And it bans communication by sex workers in public places that are near playgrounds, schools, or daycares. And so what you see is a specific targeting of street-based sex workers, again, and a banning of all client communication, which, of course, we all know the impacts that will have on health and safety. There's a new prohibition on materially benefiting from prostitution that, again, to me, reads identically or in an identical way to the living on the avails law, although they say that they carved out exceptions for third parties that may be safety enhancing. I don't read the legislation in that way, and I think that it's both going to create the same problems in terms of sex workers being able to work with others, as well as the same risks and harms. And finally, there's a procuring law that mimics the procuring law that was in place before. That law actually wasn't challenged in the case. So I'm going to take my last few minutes to talk about looking forward and what's to come. The first thing I want to say is that Canadians are so ready for decriminalization. The public opinion polls, the level of awareness and understanding has changed unbelievably and substantially in the 10 years I've been doing this work. I cannot believe how much easier it is to talk about this issue. People care, which is in and of itself an amazing change. But the rationale, the awareness around the harms of criminalization, people don't necessarily know exactly where we should go, but they know that the status quo is failing. They understand the connection that those laws had to sex workers' lack of safety. And they're open to decriminalization. And they are certainly committed, it would seem, in large part, to ensuring that the new laws don't reproduce the old. And what PIVOT is working really hard to do, what sex workers are working really hard to do, is deepen that, make sure it's even more nuanced, to make sure Canadians really understand. But the decision was an incredible public education tool. And one of the ways that we're seeing that sort of manifest is in terms of law enforcement. So we've had now just over 2 months, 2.5 months since the law came into force. And I don't know if this is going to remain the case, but based on my understanding, speaking to communities and sex workers and tracking media, there's been very little enforcement of this law across the country, and which is fascinating. There's going to be no enforcement in Vancouver. The Vancouver Police Department have committed to not enforcing laws that target consensual adult sex work, and that's a written policy. And we see the government of Ontario saying we're very concerned about these laws, and the government of Ontario is, in fact, thinking about referring it to the court. The police in Ontario are saying, well, what are we supposed to do when our premier is delivering a message that these laws may be harmful? So we're seeing a very interesting, it's unlike Sweden, where the police came, like, as soon as the law came into force, the police were out there, guns blazing, targeting clients everywhere that they could. That, of course, settled down when they realized it wasn't working. But there was an initial kind of frenzy of law enforcement activity. We're seeing the exact opposite of Canada. We're seeing a general disinterest in enforcing these laws. The second thing is that the movement has never been stronger. And I love this slide, and I rarely get to use it because I'm often talking to, folks that don't want to see underwear that say we fuck to win. But this is just an amazing image, and it really represents where the movement is at. And I won't say much about this except to say that I'm seeing a cohesion and a strategic thinking and a level of organization across the country like I've never seen before in my 10 years or more of doing this. Sex workers are unified, they're committed, they're focused, they know what they want. We have all learned so much together over the last decade, and we really feel ready. PIVOT, of course, is ready. We have a new lawyer who's joining us who's going to be leading the next round of litigation. And we and Suave, Suave has retained us to carry on with the next challenge. And we're now just thinking strategically, how do we support the movement nationally to bring the case forward? But the last thing I want to say, or one of my last points, is that this case, as we will see it, as the new litigation will take place, we'll see a different approach. We will still see that core safety argument. It's necessary, it's important, it has to be there. But I really believe it's time and extremely important that we flush that out and that we move beyond talking just about personal safety to expand the argument to include other rights and other protections and other interests. So, for example, I think a focus on health will be really important. I think a focus on equality will be really important in terms of taking that argument around safety and then bringing in an equality argument around what does this mean for oppressed groups? What does this mean for gender equality? What does this mean for trans justice? What does this mean for poverty and marginalization? Making the argument that decriminalization is actually furthering all of those areas of justice. And then finally, I think it's really time to start talking about personal autonomy and talking about sex workers' right to do what they want with their bodies when they feel like it. And it was an argument that I think people were a bit nervous about, and it felt safer, and we did too, to rest with safety and make sure the argument, but it's really time to move into that broader, more diverse argument for so many reasons, including making sure Canadians and the world knows that this is really a diverse industry with diverse experiences, and really starting to flesh out that whole question of choice in an empowered way and in an honest way. The last thing I want to say, and then I'm going to pass it over to Adrian, is that, oh, this was my equality piece that I forgot to advance. The last thing I just want to say is that this case, as we will see it, the challenge to the new laws, I believe, could have global implications like we have not seen before. And the reason is this. If we could have the Supreme Court of Canada strike down a law that prohibits the purchase of sex, saying that it violates sex workers' fundamental constitutional rights, and if we can make sure that we're being strategic and thoughtful about how to make sure that has a ripple effect and international implications throughout the world, I believe that, unlike Bedford, this case could change everything. I think that we could be, Canada could be a very important piece in turning the tide on this sort of global movement towards banning, you know, buying sex and new forms of criminalization. I think with Bedford, people were able to distinguish from those laws and say, oh, we've moved on from there. We're Sweden. Don't worry. We've got something very different going on here. And I think this case could be really monumental in terms of challenging that and looking at countries around the world and making sure that they know that that approach wasn't working in Canada, was harmful, violated fundamental human rights, and is having the same effect everywhere.
Thanks, everybody, for those joining us by audio. I'm Adrian Smith, and I am Pivot's Health and Drug Policy Staff Lawyer. I would love the time for that. Mm-hmm. The goals of our campaign is to have drug use read as a health issue and not as a crime, and to make sure that drug users have timely access to fair health care that keeps them alive in their communities. Today I'm going to talk to you about four, maybe five things if there's a time at the end. The first is about a right to maintenance treatment for drug users, and we're working on a case around prescription heroin to strengthen that right in Canada. The second is defending a right to supervised injection services. This is a follow-up to the Insight case that quite famously went to the Canadian Supreme Court of Canada. And that is a challenge to new legislation by the same very arch-conservative federal government that's criminalizing sex work. The third is a right to health, basic harm reduction health care in prison. And the last is challenges to a suite of law and order, tough on crime initiatives that our government has introduced that have a particularly egregious impact on drug users and sex workers. And then we'll talk about our future plans if there is time. I want to start by saying a little bit about the way that Pivot does its work, because you might have guessed that we are not just lawyers. This is an image of the First United Church, which stopped doing church in the downtown east side and is merely a shelter and social service agency. And this image, I think, is a delightful contrast. This is an image of the puny justices of the Supreme Court of Canada. And we take this story and we take it here, so it's coherent. And we are a kind of activist lawyer in an unfamiliar way. This is an image of a lawyer in his robes with a megaphone in the street at a protest. And part of our work necessarily involves that public education piece, so that I sit down at Thanksgiving dinner with my mother and we're talking about sex work in an enlightened way. And that means that when we win these decisions and we take them down the steps of the courthouse, they actually have an impact on the way Canadians see the law and justice. I would like to talk now about heroin-assisted treatment, and I would like to take an opportunity to thank Scott Bernstein, who had my position before me, who really set lots of these ducks in a row for us, and I feel very much like I'm standing on his shoulders when...
And what a great t-shirt you're wearing.
I think we're both wearing some fantastic t-shirts.
It's a nice poster in the back,
too.
Yeah.
Everybody sees what they want to see.
For the benefit of the auto recording, my t-shirt says Insight Saves Lives, and it's has a picture of a syringe on it, which gets you lots of comments when you wear it internationally. So I'm sure many people in the room know Vancouver had a horrific epidemic, which would really take a lifetime to tell, so I won't. But the way that we solved that, epidemic overdose rates, epidemic infection rates, was that drug users in the community came together in the same way that we're seeing sex workers unite as a movement. And they made the government listen to them. And community activists working with those user groups established the first supervised injection site in Canada, where drug users can inject illicit drugs that they buy on the street under medical supervision, and there are people there to intervene should they overdose and to connect them with social services if they're ready for that. Its ability to exist is also a long story, and it led to a series of litigations that took us to the Supreme Court of Canada that enshrined a constitutional right to supervised injection services for drug users in Canada. And there's me in the red hat reading the decision while everybody else is celebrating here in front of Insight. So if there is a hero, and it is our community, there's also a villain to this story. This is Peter McKay, who was responsible for this really egregious sex work legislation. And the person seated beside him is our Minister of Health, Rona Ambrose, who is the bad guy in lots of these cases I'm going to tell you about. So this is another lovely healthcare facility in our neighborhood. This is the Providence Crosstown Clinic. It was the site of a drug trial testing prescription heroin, which we know is effective because there had been a study in Vancouver called Naomi, against hydromorphone for maintenance to see if hydromorphone was as effective. We found that the 202 people in the study had fantastic advances in their health and their social functioning. So their doctors applied to keep them on their prescription heroin, which had stabilized them when their time in the study ended. Health Canada agreed, but then the Minister of Health changed the legislation. There, you can boo and hiss at her if you like. So we took her to court, saying that that change was unconstitutional. This is one of the litigants in the middle. His name is Dave Murray, and he's holding a copy of the injunction that keeps him on his medication until this case can come to trial. But we do foresee this being a long litigation. I've blocked off the next 6 years to take this to the Supreme Court of Canada. And we're hoping that access to prescription heroin is available to anybody in Canada for whom it's medically appropriate, and move it beyond the 200 people who are covered by the injunction. The second is the Respect for Communities Act. This is Bill C-2. This is a very much like you heard that the laws were struck down. The court ruled there was a constitutional right, and then the government brought in horrible legislation in the sex work context. The decision in Portland Hotel Society and Attorney General of Canada, which enshrined our right to access to supervised injection services for users in Vancouver and around the country, in theory, this conservative government is reading that court case as a directive. And there's a very small section. The whole case stands for the fact that this is a constitutionally protected right, which, unless there's a very compelling public health reason or a public safety issue, should be accessible. And then there's a small section in the third to last paragraph seems to be one of their favorites of the matter of this case. It says, and there's some other factors that you can consider, and one of those is community consultation. So what Bill C-2 does is prevent access to services by opening up, imposing a tremendous burden on applicants for additional supervised injection services, and opening up this access for community consultation for people who are not involved in healthcare and who are unfamiliar with harm reduction services. And on the same day that the bill was tabled in Parliament, the Conservative government issued a fundraising letter to all of its Conservative Party supporters saying they, us guys, this is you guys, they want to put shooting galleries next to your child's school, send us your money. So I went to Ottawa to speak to a House of Commons committee to say that this was unconstitutional and that we would litigate, that this is a settled issue, that the Supreme Court has ruled clearly on it, and that the minister is not being truthful when she says that the Supreme Court decision demands this restriction on services. And unfortunately, it's going to pass in the House of Commons this month, and then it will go off to the Senate of Canada, and it will likely be law before we have a federal government in October. So we're looking at relitigating Insight on different facts, and because of the progress that we've already made organizing user groups and service providers, there are national talks among applicants and user groups to talk about how we're going to come up with a concerted challenge. I still remain dimly hopeful that they will stall long enough for the government to change, but I have simple lawyer hopes. Prison needle exchange litigation. This is an Ontario case, and it is challenging the federal corrections ban on sharps. We're taking it in Toronto. We were just in Toronto. It was so beautiful. It's an image of Toronto. So what we know is that drug use doesn't stop when you go to jail. It just becomes more expensive and it becomes more dangerous. Here are some images of a do-it-yourself guide for making a syringe in jail and a couple of syringes that have been confiscated from inmates. And we know people are making their own. We know when there is one, it's hidden, which becomes a poke danger, but also everybody uses it. And this means that the infection rates inside federal prisons in Canada are in the 80%. 95% of prisoners are released eventually, and they're sent out into the community, which is a substantial public health issue as well as a matter of basic justice. What is particularly galling is that the corrections legislation that governs how prisons are run says that prisoners are entitled to the same level of health care inside than they are in the community, but this ban on sharps is preventing access to supervised injection or to harm reduction services in prison, and we would like to change that landscape so it looks less like this and more like this. This is an image of standard syringes that you would see in any needle exchange. The last thing that is clearly within our health and drug policy, which may not be an intuitive drug issue, is challenges to new mandatory minimum prison sentences, which are legislated. They're extremely popular. Our government is taking the worst cues from American tough on crime, jail for everybody legislation, and bringing in a suite of changes which limit community service options for people, limit diversion, require that people serve their sentences in jail, require that those jail terms be a particular length of time in these facilities where there is no service and no hope of rehabilitation. It is nonsensical and it's unjust. So Pivot intervened in the case of a downtown Eastside, very low-level drug dealer. Most of these, the really interesting mandatory minimums are in the context of drug use, but they also exist for a number of other crimes, including sex work, which is why it's interesting for Pivot. So this is the case of Lloyd. Mr. Lloyd is a 25-year-old resident of the downtown Eastside. He was caught riding his bicycle on the sidewalk without a helmet. So the police searched him and they found about 10 grams of a collection of crystal meth, heroin, and cocaine. Mr. Lloyd was admitted to trafficking. He told the provincial court that he was selling the drugs that he had on him. And He also explained that he was paid for his work as a low-level drug dealer in these three drugs, all of which to which he was addicted, which is a very common aspect of the structure of the drug trade on the ground in Vancouver. People are hired, and they'll be given a certain amount of drugs, and if they sell most of it, they can keep a little bit, or they'll be paid later for their time. But because he has a previous drug conviction, a mandatory minimum of 1 year was in play, so his defense attorney brought a challenge and said that this would violate our constitutional protection against cruel and unusual punishment. And the provincial court judge agreed. The Crown appealed it to the BC Court of Appeal, and here we are intervening. Unfortunately, what the Court of Appeal did was decline to hear the constitutional argument. They just decided that the sentence that Mr. Lloyd had been given was insufficient and gave him an additional 6 months. And we are waiting to hear if our Supreme Court of Canada will hear this appeal. At the same time, another set of cases came out of Ontario, which had to do with minimums for firearms offenses, which have not been, they don't have the same social standing in Canada as they do in the United States, because guns are much, there's no constitutional right to bear arms in Canada. They are rarer and they appear in urban centers. This suite of Ontario cases came out of Toronto, where all of the applicants were people of color, and there were many interveners on that ground saying that mandatory minimums are going to have a disproportionate effect on people who come from marginalized communities of color. We intervened because this is the case. It's a case called Nur. It was heard with another case called Charles, and these came out of six cases that were heard together by the Ontario Court of Appeal. Those cases struck down the mandatory minimum for drug charges, so the Crown appealed it to the Supreme Court of Canada. We intervened because this is the case that's going to determine how the cruel and unusual protection in our Constitution is understood by the courts, and that's very relevant to our drug use. It was a very turbulent week for me because it was the same week that we spoke on the supervised injection bill, and luckily in Ottawa, the Supreme Court and Parliament are right together in this block. For the audio, this is me standing in front of the Supreme Court of Canada sign on their front lawn, but I'm opening my lawyer clothes and showing off an Insight t-shirt because that's how we litigate, and it's a very exciting time for us to be lawyers. I didn't think working for a Vancouver downtown east side not-for-profit was going to send me off to talk in New York and to litigate all over the place, and it's an extremely exciting time for us because it's no longer blinded by the capacity of our own province to bring litigation, and Pivot's really moving into a place when we're coordinating legislation, legislative recommendations, and challenge litigation across the country. A third thing that I will touch on only briefly is a glimmer of the future for Pivot. It's not yet a official campaign of ours, but it is a flashpoint in the world for the emerging protection of existing rights for transgender, transsexual, and gender non-conforming people in Canada. There's been some federal legislation recently which sought to add these to the Canadian Bill of Rights and to increase protection against hate crimes. Unfortunately, some hateful senators have just amended this bill this week, which will send it back to the House of Commons, so it won't be law federally. We're doing a little bit better on the ground. The Vancouver Parks Board has just brought in a trans accessibility policy, which means people can use whatever change room they want. There are accessible forms. The Vancouver School Board has also just brought in a trans inclusion policy, which will protect little children. And Pivot was active in the hearings for both of those cases. And a third thing that's happening is a challenge to the inclusion of sex or gender markers on British Columbia birth certificates, because for trans, intersex, gender non-conforming people, these will never appropriately describe them. And having a mismatch of ID is a barrier to full citizenship for trans folks. Other questions?
Awesome. So, first, thank you both for two fascinating presentations. I'm sure there are lots of questions in the room. So I want to open up for Q&A, but ask you to please state your name and affiliation for the benefit of the recording and also for those on the phone. Yes.
Thank you both for a fabulous presentation. It was great to hear so much about the diversity of the work. I maybe just wanted to ask a question about the media engagement that you flagged earlier and why you think, what was different this time in the way that you managed to get conservative media on board as part of the overall advocacy?
I mean, I think there's a few parts to that answer. One would be that it was a long time coming and there was a lot of public education and media education along the way. And I think it was sort of building up to that point in time. Also, during that year, our media outreach strategy was very proactive. We were meeting with media, whether they wanted to write, whether they were planning to write about it or not, and saying, we just want 10 minutes with you over coffee to tell you about this issue. And so we were meeting with, you know, editorial boards and leaders within the major sort of media outlets and papers, just to educate them and say, we don't know if you're writing about this or if you're going to, but we just want 10 minutes to tell you about the issue. And then and we had communication strategists brought onto our team like we had never had before, and they brought so much expertise to the work. So, I mean, an experience I had never had before was going in to do a national sort of CTV interview, and on the way in, our communications people grabbing journalists like in the hallways and just having these amazing conversations on our way in. And that's just not anything I'd been ever capable of, because I didn't know to grab them. I didn't know I could. And so it was really felt next level. And so while I was getting, you know, that silly makeup on that they put on you before you go on TV, I'd be talking to other, you know, reporters who the communications people would have grabbed from the hallway. So it was really, really incredible to kind of do that next level communications. The last thing I'll say, though, is that the legislation was so bad that it wasn't hard for people to criticize it. So I actually wonder if the legislation had been less bad, would it have been harder to drum up the level of critique that we did? But it was so bad that people had no problem saying, this is ridiculous. Whereas had it been a little bit less, you get my point. So both from the parties as well as from the media, it was very easy for them to say this is outrageous because it so clearly replicated the framework that had just been struck down.
So Tamar and Avi.
Well, thank you both. Really great presentations and also amazing work that you're sharing with us. I was really struck by how you said there has been an evolution and the concern was about safety in the beginning, but now it's more about dignity and equality and autonomy. Can you say more how that shift has taken place? Did the case play a big role in that? And also how that's playing out? Is it now the arguments that you're leading with are different?
I think, I mean, what I would give credit to in large part is sex workers courageously telling their stories. I think that the movement in Canada has been doing an amazing job to the extent that they can in a criminalized environment and in a very oppressive environment. Really making sure Canadians start to understand the diversity that exists so that, you know, we represent Suave, which is a collective of street-based sex workers. We're aware that that representing Suave is, you know, representative of sex workers is not true. They represent a small percentage of the sex industry. And what we needed to make sure was that sex workers across the country were supported to say, we are, you know, sister organizations to Suave, or we are sisters to Suave, but we are different in that we work in these environments, or we work with these resources, or we work in this way. So I think the diversity has been essential and has started to kind of come up, and people are starting to recognize that street-based sex work and that sort of those very constrained circumstances and constrained choices are not representative, and that there's this huge population of sex workers that are doing sex work for all the same reasons we all do our jobs, which is because we like it or because it's economically, you know, makes sense for us, or because, you know, all of the same factors are operating. And so I really think that that is the key piece. But I also think that the courts are being presented with and are thinking about sexuality differently. And that is, it's time to integrate that in as well and say, you know, this really is about, you know, the Canadians agree that the government doesn't belong in the bedrooms of the nation, to, you know, quote a former prime minister. That applies here too.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you so much. My name is Avi. I work in the public health program as well. And I know that that your focus is on the legal challenges, and it was fascinating to hear the presentation. But I'm also curious, there was a point where you mentioned some of the tactics that I think you said it was the Conservative Party trying to drum up support. And I'm curious about the messaging, actually, that's tied into the legal challenges that you're bringing, because I think that when you have folks on one side saying, you know, beware, there'll be sex workers, you know, next to your child's school, what is the response to that, or what is the messaging that you're putting forward to sort of paint a different picture, and what is that picture? Mm-hmm. Because I think that this is an issue that in a lot of the areas in which we work, there are sort of the legal bases for the work, which can be, in fact, very different from how we actually begin to change the way we talk about these issues. So I'm curious, on that level, how are you focusing on changing the narrative around this?
Sure, that's a great question. Just to back up for a second and talk about the government's messaging. I mean, the government had a very good time sort of playing both sides of a coin. On one hand, saying we care about victims and we care about sex workers and we are trying to rescue them by making sure prostitution never happens in Canada. Mm. And we're not judging sex workers for where they're at. We know that this is because they have no choices and they're victims in all of this. And at the same time, being able to play to the moralism that exists among you know, conservative members of Canadian society who say prostitution is bad and sex workers are bad and they're all bad and everything about it is bad and it should be stamped out. So they sort of just played back and forth between those two lines of sort of reasoning and justification, depending on who their audience was. And it was quite fascinating to watch them do that in the media and to try to reconcile those two perspectives. But what that was the key messaging brought forward. In terms of our work and what we need to be thinking about is that, and this is part of the reflection piece, is when you focus so wholeheartedly on safety and you don't bring in equality and you don't talk about autonomy, you don't talk about personal freedom and control over one's body and all of those dimensions of this issue, do you feed into that ability to say this is actually all about victimization? And upon reflection, I think that the litigation was strategic and that we chose a winning argument and that was the one. But I do think that we fit into, to a certain extent, a sort of narrow perspective on who sex workers are and what their experiences are. And it became all about safety, which then fed into this, is sex work inherently unsafe? And therefore, it was too narrow. And what we really need to do this time is be thoughtful and strategic, both inside the courtroom and out, to make sure that we are representing sex work for what it really is and for why it really happens, all of the diversity sort of I've touched upon, and make sure that we are clear that this is about safety. This is all about autonomy as well. This is all about ending stigma, discrimination, and you know, advancing equality. It's all of those things all at the same time, and making sure we are more nuanced and less afraid to do all of that at the same time. And I think that the work of the movement has kind of brought us to that place where we can do that a little bit more confidently.
It's also really important that we work directly with sex workers and that there's a person who can stand up and say, I'm a former sex worker, this law is not actually going to protect me, and from my experience, this is what I think. Because they don't have that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Seb?
You touched on that briefly, but I was wondering if you could say more about the challenge of speaking for populations in these really important venues and how you think through things like feedback and exchange and dialogue and pitfalls. I think lessons that we could learn too.
I think it's really important for me never to do what I think is right, but to check in. It's often very helpful to rely on those old rules of being a lawyer, that you take instruction. Mm. And if you're taking instruction from a community, that's more complicated because they're going to be divided and there's going to be a debate, and often the people who are advising you don't have an answer yet. And it's been great to watch the sex worker community come to a collective understanding about what laws they want to push. I meet with drug users and they write to me every day and say, I didn't get into the study and I need heroin and here's my story and here's why. And when I sit at my desk and I'm buried in law and I feel like this is impossible and I'm never going to fight this government, I go to an organizing meeting at the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and they talk about their issues and I live in the neighborhood and people stop me in the grocery store and say, hey, what's going on with that? And I need to never remember. This last slide is interesting because it partly answers your question. This is a photograph on the left of the alley behind our office, which is a lived-in alley. People live in it and they live in the buildings attached to it. And this is my last block when I walk to work. And the slide on the right is a picture of me in a suit, in a white shirt, outside the BC Supreme Court. And I can't do the one on the right without being in the place on the left. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Naomi?
So thank you so much again for coming to share this. Your work is incredibly inspiring. I wanted to ask a question about your drug work, very much following on from Sebastian's. I was wondering, with the kind of strategic kind of suite of legal strategies you've used, how do you think that's influenced or kind of increased the community's awareness of their rights and their ability to claim or to fight back against something? And you kind of just touched on it then.
There's a necessary feedback in that because we need to be connected, but also because Pivot is Pivot, and we have this really global reputation now, I think it's a testament to how unlawyerly we've been in the neighborhood that the community still trusts us. And I got a phone call very late at night on my mobile phone, and I was in my pajamas watching TV, and it was the coordinator of the supervised injection site calling me to tell me about a really terrible thing that had happened to a participant in the facility who had been assaulted, and she told the police what had happened. She was a drug user and a sex worker and an Aboriginal woman. And she omitted a detail, which is that she fought back against her attackers and she cut one of them. There were three of them. And she wanted to know what the legal implications were of that and if she needed to call the police and say that she had not been entirely truthful. And that the community calls us for that kind of feedback, and that we are a resource. And that all day long the phone rings, and when there's a place to send someone and there's a crisis in legal services in Canada and there's not often a place to send them, but we're the place they call. Does that answer your question?
Scott?
Yeah. So I want to talk a bit about drug policy. And
really?
So, yeah, I do. So, you know, I think for many years, Canada was seen as being a leader in harm reduction and treatment of people who use drugs. And, you know, and obviously the insight was the big focal point for look how far we've come. And, you know, I think things like Bill C-2 and the Canadian position it takes in international meetings where it now fights tooth and nail against putting the words harm and the words reduction in the together in the same sentence. You know, I think that's there's this bit of a shift now, and obviously the fighting against insight. So I'm wondering, what do you see as kind of Pivot's role and the role of strategic litigation in getting that back? Like, how do you know you talked to Adrian about being having a global reputation? Like, what's Pivot's piece in the global movement? Like, where's the advance come?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely a problem, and the fact that we have an extremely conservative government has tarnished Canada's reputation in lots of ways. I'm not proud of the positions that Canada takes internationally because they're the same positions that they take on social policy and crime issues elsewhere. I think we are lucky right now that it's a popular time to be challenging a conservative government, because the longer they're in office, the more things they do that seem to be so far over the top that regular Canadians who might have supported fiscal restraint and military support initiatives in the beginning of their reign are very different. But I found it very helpful to move the conversation back to the place that we need to be talking. So if somebody says,
we can't have a needle exchange that encourages drug use. I would like the end goal to be that there is nobody using drugs. Or I would like the end goal to be that there's no longer prostitution in Canada. It's super helpful to roll back, which is the discussion that we've been having in harm reduction advocacy everywhere, and say, I don't have an end position about what that looks like, but none of it is going to work if people aren't alive to get there. And in the meantime, what do you need? You can't just plan a better arc. You need to be bailing in the meantime.
I mean, can I add to that?
Yeah.
To say that our work has been very domestically focused, mm-hmm. And we have obviously relied on litigation as our key tactic. Our hope being that Canada can become a model, that it becomes something that the world looks at and says, oh, look at Canada, they're going the right way. This government is like a constant make-work project for us. We mm-hmm. wish that we didn't have so much litigation ongoing. And this is actually, you know, I mean, we're like bulging at the seams as an organization in terms of our capacity to do all of this. And there's more coming down. And we're sort of struggling to figure out how are we going to do it all. But one of the questions that I think we need to be posing to ourselves and challenging ourselves, even in light of all of that, is what can we make sure we can do to make sure that our Supreme Court of Canada, that is an amazing court, that takes a Charter of Rights and Freedoms and brings it and breathes life into it, into real rights on the ground, how can we make sure that's having an impact internationally? And how can we make sure that that... And I don't think we have a good answer for that. I don't think we're a very sophisticated organization right now in that respect, because we've been so focused on the ground in our community and with our national court. But I do think that the sex work campaign in its next iteration, I think drug policy, are going to be two places where we start asking ourselves some of those hard questions, which is what more can Pivot be doing so that when we generate, or if we are able to be part of these big wins, that it has a lasting effect in Canada as well as an effect around the world, because we're certainly feeling it as, you know, the Swedens and Norways of the world, and the claims they're making about prostitution laws are impacting us. So it's really important that we're able to see that impact as well.
And I just want to follow up, like, you know, for example, the Insight case is unique in the world because no government elsewhere actually went in and tried to shut down an injection site. So it actually teed up the opportunity to get into court to articulate those rights. And so it's, you know, it's a there's no other case like it that's really articulated human rights around supervised injection. So I think, like, you know, and I know internationally that's looked at as a model, like, oh, look
totally.
At this, look at what this means and what the court mm-hmm. said about it. So
it's not insignificant that the Supreme Court of Canada and the House of Parliament stand side by side on this same escarpment looking over the river in Ottawa, because it's an important object lesson that there's two ways to change the law, and one is through the Parliament and one is through the courts. And we mustn't forget to do both all the time. And right now, because our government is so bad, the court is the best place to push. But if our government were to soften and become more progressive, there'd be no need to litigate, but we would do more work with a receptive government to make the kinds of laws that don't result in this harm and deal with the harm that already exists.
So I want to just check if we have anyone on the phone who would like to ask a question.
Is
that Anne?
This is Anne.
Yeah.
Hi, Anne.
Yeah. Hi, Katrina. Hi, Vivian.
Hello.
Thanks for doing this. I've been on the phone calling from Nairobi. So you alluded to some of the arguments you've been making in the strategic litigation. Could you speak to how different you think the strategy is going to be in going forward than what happened in the Bedford case?
Do you mean the litigation strategy?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't have an answer for that because we're really in that sort of analysis stage. We are in conversation and working with sex worker organizations across the country right now to both sort of, we're building our legal kind of strategy and thinking about the ways the argument could unfold kind of within Pivot right now, and sharing that and thinking about that collectively with the movement. to then think about where should litigation happen, in what provinces, should there be more than one case as there was in the Suave and Bedford era, should there be one mega case, do you take the whole piece of legislation on in one shot, do you pull pieces out? There's a lot of strategic questions that we need to think about that we're going to be doing between kind of now and throughout summer, with the hopes being that we know and are planning and maybe even carrying out sort of the initial steps of litigation in the fall.
And we can't make those decisions by ourselves.
That's right.
Going to be something that the national movement does.
Yeah. So what's great and another real strength about now and compared to sort of 2005 when we started to get Suave ready is that this is happening nationally now, whereas back then it wasn't happening nearly in this type of coordinated, strategic, awesome way. Back then it was just more piecemeal. People were sort of working in their own areas, and the litigation unfolded in the way that it did, which was great. But now it's really happening at this national level. And I'm very excited to see that, and Pivot feels really lucky to be part of that process.
Okay.
Sarah?
Hi, thank you, you guys. So my questions kind of build on the last two that went along. I mean, I think it's so important for people to recognize, like non-Canadians in the room, that what a weird thing is happening in Canada, where we're having these great Supreme Court victories, and then the government is essentially end-running them. Mm-hmm. Right, through legislation, and that was true with with the Insight case, and it's true with the Bedford case too, and so like it just raises a really important question that others have kind of touched on, which is like on the one hand the Bedford case was a great victory, then they put into place worse legislation than what we started with, but on the other hand there was, you guys used it and it was such a great opportunity for galvanizing and bringing together the national sex worker mm-hmm. movement and for a lot of public education. And actually for thoughts about, like you pointed out, a future case with challenging the new laws, which would be even more far-reaching than the current case. So it's just a very complex situation strategically that you guys and the movement are facing. And I guess I sort of wanted to dig into your thoughts about that a little bit and maybe put to you the question, maybe it's a weird question, but our president puts it to us when we do these portfolio reviews, which is, if you knew then what you know now, like, if you knew that Harper was going to end run your great victory, would you have done anything differently? Or are these pieces, the galvanizing of the movement, the public education, are they all leading towards the end and these are necessary steps?
I'll go first to say, yes, we wouldn't have done it again. And we would. And that is because we are in a better place in Canada now than we were pre-Bedford. The legislation is going to be harmful and is harmful in all sorts of ways, but there are material changes that we can mark and note. For example, sex workers are not being arrested in the way that they were, and they cannot and won't be arrested in the same way that they were. We have a decision from the Supreme Court of Canada in our back pocket that provides everything we need, frankly, to move forward with the next challenge. And the public education, all of those things have been amazing. I think that as an organization, the question that every strategic litigation group needs to think about is, do you file challenges to legislation in the hopes that those laws will be struck down and clear the slate when you have a government in power like we do? And that is a fundamental question that we need to be asking ourselves at all times, which is, do we want to clear the slate for them? Or do we just rest with what is there? Mm-hmm. And the reality is that each time you secure one of these court decisions, you build, this incredible arsenal, I hate that word, sorry, this incredible toolkit. it's less aggressive, but it's not quite aggressive enough. Anyway, you build what you need for the fight and for the movement and for the struggle. So the answer is yes, we would have done it just as we did. But it doesn't mean 2014 wasn't an unbelievably hard year to reconcile. Yeah.
But in a sense, it's also good. I didn't litigate Insight. It was one of those cases that I read as a young law student and thought, maybe not so young law student, and thought, oh, that's so amazing. I'd love to be able to do that work. But now that I am a lawyer, there's something really elegant about being able to go to a government hearing
and called the federal minister of health a liar on the record because she's mischaracterizing what the court decision says. Because it's a thick read. I didn't understand it the first several times through. And particularly constitutional law in Canada has a whole different lexicon, and the principles are not intuitive. And to be able to explain to the public, we already won this. This is what the decision says, and this is what it means. And this new law is just as bad, and it's worse in these ways. That's a present. Mm-hmm. Not just because we have this tremendous record and all the evidence is there, and what's left for us to is to gather evidence of new harm, but to say, come on now, we've already settled this.
So we have a few more minutes for another question or two. Alyssa?
Yeah, sure. So there's an election this year. I guess I'm wondering how much of an impact is that planning having on your work? And do you see any of these issues being election issues?
Over to me. Well, I think we are all still just reeling from... There was a suggestion that the election would come early. Although we have fixed election dates, this government is not very excited about the rule of law, and they would call it whenever they want. And we are expecting a March election. It seems like there will not now be a March election. There has been a really high-profile shooting in Ottawa of... gunman went into the House of Parliament. He was a member of our community, known to lots of service providers in Vancouver, and he was very mentally ill. But now he's become the basis for a really invasive suite of anti-terrorist legislation that's going to chisel away at Canadian civil liberties. And all of the parliamentary calendar and a lot of civil society organizations are quite distracted by this. The problem is that's the election issue, and people's fear of the specter of terror, which Americans in the room will be really familiar with, particularly in the city, because we're in New York, will understand it's quite familiar. I think the way to get these issues on the table, we've very much already done, because when we're in the room at Parliament talking to people about this legislation, there are opposition members of Parliament who aren't allowed to do anything, particularly in this era, because the Conservatives are governing very differently than governing parties have been before. It used to be you could go to a parliamentary committee, somebody would propose an amendment, and it would pass. Now none of that happens. The government introduces legislation, it goes through this committee stage, comes back unchanged, and is passed. But those members were all in the room, and they've been listening to us all along. And they've been taking good positions and opposing sex work legislation, opposing anti-injection site legislation. I think the test will be if a Liberal government is elected, and the joke about the Liberal government in Canada is that they govern like New Democrats, the leftist, they campaign like New Democrats, the leftist party, but they govern like Conservatives. And whether that's still true is a question of whether we continue aggressive litigation or whether we can cooperate and contribute to making the situation better in Canada. So that choice we can't make. The voters will make it.
Jonathan?
Yeah, thank you both. So such brilliant work and great presentations. My question is almost a rhetorical question. What Sarah, I think, rightly refers to as this kind of end run around the courts, it's sometimes politely referred to as a dialogue between the branches of government, you know, the two buildings on the bluff, to sort of talking to each other, and, no, we'll tweak it this way, we'll tweak it this way. But in fact, it seems like such a blatant flouting of the judicial branch of government. And the kind of rhetorical question is, where is the accountability for that? And, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've thought about it, and are there kind of contempt proceedings, or is there a public campaign of accountability? You mentioned tweaking the argument from more of a safety argument to more of a privacy argument, but it seems to be a whole other public narrative you have to develop around just the utter disrespect for the courts that this government is displaying, not just in this area, but in many other areas as well. And people who care about separation of powers and the Canadian Constitution, they need to stop talking about this as a dialogue and start naming it mm-hmm. as a total power grab mm-hmm. by the Prime Minister and his kind of cronies in Parliament. What's the strategy there?
There was a recent scandal about the appointment of a new justice to our Supreme Court. Uh-huh. And the Prime Minister took a really personal public pot shot at the Chief Justice, who had called his office, as is part of her role, to say that the applicants that you've sent to us are not appropriate because there's some criteria that are not met. And he was really nasty to her, and the Canadian public rallied behind her and said, no, actually, the Chief Justice seems like a nice woman. That's not cool. So I think people aren't referring to it softly as a dialogue anymore. And whenever one of these mandatory minimum sentences is struck down, the right-wing Toronto papers say, oh, another blow for Harper, courts stand up for justice. I think there's two things to rely on, and the first is that it's not all terrible. These movements are thriving under things that are happening far away in Ottawa in paper, but people have real lives that happen in the world that are getting better because sex workers are talking to each other, drug users are organizing, homeless people are bringing constitutional challenges against the municipalities that are trying to criminalize their lives. These steps are all good. And the second thing is that my mom is talking about sex work at Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And she's a voter. And there's millions of my mom in Canada who would never have thought about sex worker safety as an election issue until we had duked it out in the court for years.
Mm-hmm.
Ditto. Do you want to talk about the challenge to the Minister of Public Safety?
No. I mean, we're the question in Toronto?
Yeah.
I don't know. We are right now thinking about and contemplating what more we might be able to do to increase accountability and whether there's some possibility for a directed legal action. But I don't know the answer yet. And we're, just starting to try to bring in some people that are way smarter than me to figure that out.
Our Attorney General in British Columbia was censured by his law society for gutting the legal aid program, and it didn't affect his ability to be a lawyer or be the Attorney General, but it did generate some media buzz, and people are now aware more of access to justice. And I think those procedural things lead to a rise in public awareness and activism more than they stop the bad conduct of a governing mm-hmm. minister.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a last question from Ralph.
Yeah, and first of all, thank you, and it's just such impressive work, and we always used to have the example of South Africa and AIDS Law Project and TAC and the really strategic litigation, but combining it with community mobilization and incredibly sophisticated media work, and I think thanks to the work of Pivot, now we have another example that is more recent in history where those three strategies are combined. So it's really incredible work, and congratulations. My question is about this prison needle exchange case. This is an area in which I have worked, and I've actually written an affidavit for the case, so I'm fully supportive of it. But there is no community of prisoners, and how are you thinking of tackling that, and what do you see? How is the public going to learn about those issues, and how can you involve prisoners and their families in this in a meaningful way?
I think there absolutely is a community of prisoners. They're just not all imprisoned at the moment. And something that I learned living in the downtown east side is that prison is a normal fact of life mm-hmm. for lots of marginalized communities, and incarceration is certain. It's just a question of how often and for how long. I think it's artificial the way we talk about our campaigns as separate campaigns, and here's sex work, and here's drug policy, mm-hmm. and here's trans rights, and here's housing, and here's over-policing. These are all the same folks. And they're all our neighbors, and there is a raft of NGOs doing work
with and for and alongside these folks. And I think neatly a lot of the harm reduction work that's happening globally ports over into this context. We're very lucky in British Columbia. Well, we're lucky in Canada because some high-profile organizations talking about civil liberties have brought a challenge to solitary confinement in prison as a practice, which is particularly egregious for trans people who are often put in segregation for their own protection. There have been some very tragic and high-profile suicides in prison. And it's a greater point of public consciousness now than it, I think, ever has been. And it's a unique factor of prison law that it all happens away from the gaze of most citizens. And those, the walls are overflowing right now. It's a good time to be doing this work. And I think those people, when sex workers go to jail, when drug users go to jail and they have this history of having organized in the community, there's a great back and forth. There's also a really high profile British Columbia case when the warden of a women's institution canceled a mother baby program that allowed women who were going to deliver their babies during their sentence could keep their babies with them. And a group of lawyers working with these women and with doctors and nurses in the facility brought a constitutional challenge, and our court said not only do these women have a constitutional right to stay with their babies, but the babies have a constitutional right to stay with their parents. And all of these flashpoints have made prison law more of a dinner table topic.
So we have to wrap up, but I want to thank you both for taking the time to speak to us. This was incredibly interesting. I've learned a lot. I'm sure others have too. And thanks also to everyone who came to the presentations.
Thank you.
Thank you.